Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Divisional weekend generally is the best weekend in football. At least it has that kind of reputation. Eight teams, four games, the best of the best. Now, if we're being honest, this time around, the first two games of the weekend were not that great. They weren't that same number of holy crap moments that we've come to expect from the divisional weekend. Then came Cleveland at Kansas City. And here comes my guy, Andy Reid, needing to bring a wheelbarrow to work every single day to cart around his onions. My man's got a massive set of stones. Nothing but respect for Big Red and the way he called that game, especially in the fourth quarter with a backup quarterback in the game. And not just any backup quarterback, but Chad Henne. Chad freaking Henne. If Patrick Mahomes is a cheat code, playing with Chad Henne in a playoff game is like playing without a controller. It's like trying to plug a Super Nintendo controller into a PS5. And yet my guy, Andrew Ryad, was able to do just that. You know that old saying, right? The old saying about a great coach, that he can take his guys and beat your guys, and he can take your guys and beat his guys, right? You know that. Well, yesterday, Andy Reid took nobody's guy and beat a damn good Browns team. But before I get to everything that went down the fourth quarter, I need to take a moment to talk to my people. I need to talk to my people. C-Town, pull up a chair. Let's wrap. Let's chat. Now, I'm going to spare you the line about how you've got nothing to be ashamed of, even though that's true. Nor am I going to say something truly hack like, don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened. You know why I'm not going to do that? Because yesterday sucked. I mean, it really did. The Cleveland Browns, the team that nobody believed in outside the 53 men in that locker room, and the one right here in this studio, went into Kansas City, and they had the defending champs on the ropes. That game was right there for them, right there for the taking. They were this close to advancing to the AFC Championship game. This freaking close. In fact, I'll go a step further. They didn't even play their best game, and they were still right in it. They were still right there. They made mistakes. They had drops. And they were still right freaking there. But there are no consolation prizes. No. This Browns team went big game hunting this year. They weren't just looking to reach the playoffs or just get to the divisional round. They were looking for the Lombardi. And they were this close. That's how good. That's how tough this team was. And yes, they inspired an entire nation. They restored everybody's faith in humanity. But again, there are no consolation prizes. They're not going to make up a trophy for themselves just to make themselves feel better. Because as Baker Mayfield has been saying all along, this is the new standard. This is not a fluke or an exception. This is what is to be expected. And they're going to get right back on that grind. They'll come back even better next season. Stronger, better, faster. And did I say better? And I can't wait. I cannot wait. Oh, and one more note on yesterday. From a Cleveland perspective, man, they got robbed. They got jobbed so hard. And I'm not saying that because I'm the one that built that Cleveland Browns bandwagon. I'm saying that because it's a fact. I'm saying this because late in the first half, they got absolutely screwed by the worst rule in football. No, that's not fair. That's not right. The worst rule in sports, all of sports, down 16-3 with less than 2 minutes to go in the first half, this happened.
Shotgun snap, drops back three, left tackle block, cocks his arm, throws down the near sideline, caught at the five, diving to the pylon, Higgins near sideline, and and
it's going to be a touchback, Kansas City. He reached for the goal line, fumbled it out of the end zone.
He sure did. Had he held on to the ball over the pylon.
Daniel Sorensen comes over, and he hits him just short of the goal line.
Catch, followed by a fumble that went through the end zone, which by rule results in a touchback. First down, Kansas City.
Unbelievable.
Exactly right. Westwood won. You know, I'm not sure what's worse about that play. The fact that Kansas City was not flagged for illegal use of the helmet, or the fact that Cleveland got jammed by the single worst rule in the history of sports. Answer, it's both. Man, that rule is so bad. That rule is terrible. But the lack of a flag was a truckload of salt into that wound. So instead of Cleveland getting a touchdown and looking at the possibility of heading into the half down 16-10 and getting the ball to start the second half, they lose the ball, they don't get the points, and then Kansas City tacks on a field goal before halftime. Again, the rule about the ball being fumbled out of the end zone and going to the defense really is the worst rule ever. I mean, it's idiotic. Seriously, there is no comparison. The catch rule thinks that that rule is moronic. If you fumble out of bounds on the one-inch line, you get the ball on the one-inch line. If you fumble 2 inches later and the ball goes out of bounds, the defense gets the ball. How does that make sense? I can answer that for you. It doesn't. It never has. You can't reward the defense for not touching the ball, let alone not recovering the ball. I mean, it's like deranged. And the worst part is, we know it's a terrible rule. Everybody has known it's a terrible rule for years, and yet it still exists. And yesterday, it bit the Browns in the ass. But as much as yesterday was about that horrible rule, it was about another rule. All right? It was about the horrible rule, and it was about this rule. This rule being that Andy Reid rules. Man, my man is the absolute best, isn't he?
All right, Jim, you're the best, man. Thanks.
No, dude, you are the best, Andy. You are the best. It's not even close. It's you and everybody else. Stop saying I'm the best, Andy.
All right, Jim, you're the best, man. Thanks.
Man, stop saying that, Coach. Stop saying that. Nobody better than you. And there is no better example of him winning a playoff game with Chad Henne as his quarterback as evidence that Andy Reid's the greatest ever. Like, I know everybody wants to say that the only reason that Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy are having the success they're having right now is because they have a once-in-a-lifetime quarterback in Patrick Mahomes. Mahomes? Except yesterday, Andy and Eric proved that all wrong, because yesterday, this happened.
Third and one, Mahomes takes it himself, runs laterally on the 45, looks for a block, dives as he got to the number, and on that bad wheel, he tried to move, and Mac Wilson hit him. Mahomes is slow to get up on the near side, very slow.
Oh, he can't stand up.
Look at him.
He may have a concussion. They're going to have to take him out for an evaluation. At the very least, they're going to take him out for an evaluation.
Oh, Trent, you're right.
Because he went to stand up, and he nearly fell over.
Mahomes, in fact, is so rubber-legged right now that his arms draped around the athletic trainers as he is trying to regain some weight on each leg, and now he walks away under his own power like he's just shaking the cobwebs free and walks to the sideline, but he's gonna have to leave.
That was scary. Very scary moment. So Mahomes goes into concussion protocol. Chad Henne comes into the game. I mean, seriously, Chad Henne. And Andy Reid figures out a way to win that game. And no, I'm not here to bury Kevin Stefanski for punting on 4th and 9 from his own 32 with 4:19 left in the game. I mean, he was going up against Chad Henne. Henne had just thrown a pick on the last possession. It was a terrible pick at that. So if you're the opposing team, you want to get the ball back in his hands because good things are bound to happen for you. And sure enough, the Browns defense gets to 3rd and 4 almost immediately. A good thing was about to happen. And yet somehow, Andy and Eric managed to avoid those good things happening for the Browns. Instead, they managed to make great things happen for themselves. Henne completes a pass for 5 yards and a first down. Then Cleveland gets that huge Myles Garrett sack on 2nd down. Then you've got them 3rd and long, exactly where you want it. 3rd and 14, and then somehow, some way, this miracle happens.
Here's Henne in trouble, trying to run for it. Running, he's going to attack! Is going to be close. Oh my goodness, I can't believe they let him get him free, and I think they've spotted him just shy. It'll be 4th and 1 foot.
In the AFC Championship game, putting your body on the line, I think he's going to get it. That's what Patrick Mahomes does, and sends Kansas City, I think, to the AFC Championship. The champs are still around, Jim.
See here, hold on a minute. This will tell it right here. It's going to be short. Now what do you do?
He almost sent him to the AFC Championship,
almost.
Jim.
I heard the almost.
One of the damnedest things I've ever seen. Like seeing a lunar eclipse and the northern lights at the exact same time. Chad Henne scrambling like that was a freak of nature event. It defied so many laws, and yet it still happened. And then my guy, Andy Reid, goes absolute legend on fourth down.
Go ahead and quarterback sneak it, motion him back, try and draw him off sides, and then take a timeout. You walk up there and say, no play, everybody. Don't jump. There's no play. Just look at the body language.
Oh, there is a play. Henne rolling out, throws it. Hell! And the Chiefs are heading to the AFC Championship game.
Only Andy Reid gets it shotgun on fourth and an inch. And throws the ball with his quarterback. There's no way. He shocked everybody.
Watching that live, I thought Tony Romo was going to have a heart attack. He was so shocked and so fired up. It was incredible. Because Andy Reid didn't go for it on fourth down with Patrick Mahomes. He did it with his backup quarterback. And not just any backup quarterback, he did it with Chad Henne. And he did it at midfield. Like, if you don't get that, you're giving the ball and every bit of momentum back to the Browns on a really short field. That was an absolutely massive play call. But then again, to my guy Andy Reid, it was nothing at all.
There was no doubt. I mean, there was no doubt. I think everybody knew we were going to go for that play on our side. I'm not telling you that in the world here, but on our sideline, guys just went, hey, there's no tomorrow. Let's go. I mean, let's roll.
Man, we should have all known. He's right when he says there was no doubt. There was no doubt on our side. I don't know about the rest of the world. Man, the rest of the world should have known. They should have known. We should have known. That's why he's Andy Reid and none of us are. That's why there's only one Andy Reid. That was a big time play call by Big Red. And that's why they're moving on, because Andy Reid is a freaking legend. And because Andy Reid loves Javier's. How do I know? He told me on this show after I saw him at Javier's.
I love the place. I mean, I love it. And you said it. There, you always see people in there that you don't expect to see. I was as excited to see you as you were me. So, I mean, we haven't talked in a long time. And we used to talk all the time, and for no reason other than I moved back to Kansas City here, and it was kind of a new start. But it was great to see you, and your family's phenomenal. I mean, you had a load there now. People don't realize that was a long table you had. You have a beautiful wife and Janet. Your son, he was beaming, man, 17 years old. It doesn't get any better. Living in California, eating at Javier's, 17-year birthday, and I mean, come on. How much better does it get?
I don't know, Coach. Going for it on fourth and one the way you did at midfield? This guy is so amazing. Andy Reid, and let me correct one thing he said. He said in that conversation that you just heard that he was more excited to see me than I was him. Biggest lie ever. Nobody has ever been more excited about anything than I was to see Andy Reid that night at Javier's in Crystal Cove. And then I got to say, man, you know I'm all about America's team. You know, nobody has been riding with them the way I have been. Front and center, shotgun on that bandwagon. If they got to go down, if they have to go down, and they have to go down the way they did, may as well be to my guy Andy Reid.
All right, Jim, you're the best, man.
No, Coach, you. I would imagine after a really good workout, you're craving some protein. So where do you go to get it? Change up. Don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper instead. Hear me out. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty. It's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. And it's a family-owned business. They take their smoked beef extremely seriously. You can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating an old shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal. Comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned, Teriyaki, Peppered, and Hot and Spicy. So the next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper Beef Jerky. Look for it in the Clearview bag. That way you can see exactly what you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He is Charles Davis. Charles, it's been a minute or two since you and I last spoke. How you doing? How's life for you right now?
I'm doing well, Jim. We're all battling the same stuff. Everyone's battling, right? And I certainly hope you and your family are well, and everyone who can hear our voices and see you on TV is feeling the same way. And look, I'm still optimistic 2021 is going to be better than 2020, although we have had a little bit of a rocky start to 2021, but we'll get right. I do believe that is our country.
You know, I agree with everything you just said. Charles Davis is joining us. I certainly do. You know, this was your first season with CBS, so let me ask you about that really quickly. What was the transition like for you, and how much fun did you have as a new member of the family?
Had a blast, an absolute blast, and I know that's the simplest, easiest thing that you can say, right? Especially if you want to continue your employment with someone new, but this time you can strap me up to the lie detector test. You can hit me with the sodium pentothal. Had an absolute blast. Could not have landed in a better place. Better people that I work with, better people that I report to. And look, if you can't work next to Ian Eagle and raise your game and work next to Evan Washburn and raise your game, then something's wrong with you. And I left a very good situation standing next to Kevin Burkhart. So for me to go from there to where I am now, phenomenal first season. I couldn't be happier.
So glad to hear it, and not at all surprised. Charles Davis is joining us. All right, let's talk about some of the matchups. Let's talk about the Buffalo Bills. Charles, they have been so explosive offensively. We know this. That said, how impressed were you with the way the defense showed up against the Ravens?
Beyond impressed, because Ian and Evan and myself did the Bills-Colts game. And Jonathan Taylor and that Colts offensive line did a nice job running the football. And in this game, you would have expected a team that's built to run the football, their whole identity is to run the football, would have more success doing what they normally do against a team that just struggled with it the week before. Didn't turn out that way. I thought Leslie Frazier, their defensive coordinator, is getting some deserved kudos. And those players picking up their game, elevating what they're doing. And look, Jim, we know about Jerry Hughes coming off the edge. We've known about that for a long time, right? Mario Addison has put numbers together in recent years in Carolina off the edge. I thought inside is where things really jumped up for them. Trey Edmonds, the middle linebacker, his game has really increased over the last half of the year. But inside, Quentin Jefferson, Vernon Butler, and I thought Harrison Phillips, who struggled for most of the year, I think his last two games have been two of his better games of the year, and that helps slow them down in the running game.
Charles Davis is joining us. All right, then. You know, I've been so impressed by what Josh Allen has done over the course of the year and how far he's come from when he first entered the league. When you watch Josh Allen right now, what sticks out to the most, or what does stick out the most to you about him and his play?
I think, Jim, for me, it's just the rapid maturity. Not that Josh was immature as a player. Remember, you and I talked, and I think we actually talked the day the stuff broke about his tweets. You remember that way back when?
Yes.
That they found right before the draft. And it's one of those things that, look, everything in life we all have to own, but we also have to have context with it. And the Josh Allen I knew from my time covering him, that was a kid who did some things that you would say probably shouldn't have done that. Really simple, right? And you look at the context of that, and then look at how his team embraces him. Have you heard about one single thing about that team? Anyone having any hesitancy with him? The answer is no, because of who he is, how he is as a person, how he leads. And I just think that maturity, and I know that last year we had those great shots of him that weren't great for him, but in the playoff game against Houston, when they're up 16-0 and then the lead started to go away and the body language wasn't great, right, and the look on his face looked a little shell-shocked, we've seen no evidence of that this year. And I'll just leave it to this, Jim. How many times have you and I talked about quarterbacks, talked about accuracy in college? If there's a question, does it get better in the NFL? And in three seasons, his accuracy percentage number has gone from what it was as a rookie to where he is this year, and that's 16 percentage points. That's unheard of in NFL. Absolutely unheard of.
Charles Davis is joining us. You know, to that point, Charles, you and I have talked about that, and it's just like this assumption, or everybody's accepted this as fact, that if you're not that accurate in college, you're just not going to be that accurate in the NFL, and he is so much more accurate in the NFL than he was in college. So how do you explain that?
I think a ton of hard work on his part, first and foremost. He has, I'm not going to say remade himself, because that's too strong, because we didn't take away the arm, did we? The arm
right.
is still there. And, boy, that arm is built for Buffalo. It's going to cut through anything. But the footwork is better. The understanding of where the ball should go and the anticipation of throws, that has increased. I think that Brian Daboll gets a lot of attention for that, and he should, because I think the two of them have worked together to retool it. Whoever he's worked with in the offseason, you know, I think it's Jordan Palmer. They've done a fantastic job. But he's put it into play, Jim, and it says, and we use the golf swing analogy all the time, but it's apt. His motion and everything that he's done in his work, it's okay on the range, but will it repeat under pressure? And for Josh, it's repeating under pressure. And let's not kid ourselves either. Stephon Diggs coming along to open things up for everyone else as well as take on the pressure of being wide receiver one, that hasn't hurt either. But the last thing I'll say, Jim, the lasting memory for me last season with Josh wasn't the playoff game. It was the game against New England, essentially for the division title. And you remember Dawson Knox coming open in the end zone, and Josh put it about in the 10th row?
I do.
We didn't see much of that this year, did we?
No.
He really has worked on it, really has increased. I just think what he's done is truly phenomenal, because look at the numbers of quarterbacks over the years. They don't increase by 16 percentage points in accuracy from college to the NFL. It is absolutely unheard of.
And they love him, and they respond to him, and they go into battle with him as well. Charles Davis is joining us. All right, so we'll wait, Charles, and see about Patrick Mahomes. In fact, we'll wait the entire week. But what are your early thoughts on the Buffalo-Kansas City matchup?
Oh, it's a matchup I think that Buffalo actually loves. You've got the underdog role. You're playing the defending champions. They jumped you pretty well in the regular season. Even though the scoreboard doesn't quite indicate it, you saw that game, Jim. Did you ever have any doubt Kansas City was winning that one?
Right.
Zero, right? They were in control all the way through. Plus, they ran the heck out of football in that game. People forgot that. That was a game where Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy saw, okay, you're going to play too deep? We'll run it. And they ran the heck out of it in that one. So if you're Buffalo, with the confidence you're bringing in this playoff run, what are they now, 11-1? Since a loss in midseason to Kansas City, they feel good about where they are right now. The key thing for them is going to be, can you slow down the track squad outside enough that Kansas City takes the bait a little bit and tries to run it, and then you clamp down on that. The last game, it wasn't really bait as much, but Kansas City never veered away from it. They stayed with it, and they ground them up running the football. As long as they don't let that happen again, we've got game on. I mean, absolute game on. And Buffalo's playing with more momentum right now, I think, than Kansas City is.
Charles Davis joining us for a few more moments. Charles, what about Kansas City advancing on the strength of Andy Reid and his decision-making? Man, he goes for it on fourth down to keep the ball. What did you make of him making that call and having the confidence to do so with a backup quarterback in the game at that time?
Well, he had a call that he absolutely loves. I thought that in the game, Tony Romo pointed out very well that this is the type of call that he likes to make. You know, that's a staple type of a call in that situation, and it's something that he knew was in Chad Henne's repertoire and arsenal. The other part is, as an offensive coach, how do you want to lose a ball game if you're going to lose it? Lose it with your guys doing their thing as opposed to turning it over to your defense. And to me, I really wasn't overly surprised, even with a backup quarterback, because momentum was still pointing towards Cleveland moving the football against his defense. And that's a defense that's good, but it reminds me a lot of the Colts with Peyton Manning. They're built to play with a lead, and then you turn them loose. A little bit different when they're slugging it out, down in and down out. I think Andy just said, I'd rather go out this way. And in this case, it worked out. And you know what the contrast is, Jim? If you take it to college football, remember Pete Carroll against Texas? Everybody said, punt it, punt it, punt it deep. He felt like there was no way we're stopping Vince Young no matter where he gets the ball. I'd rather take the chance. Lendale White comes up short, and Young sticks it in the end zone, and they win. In this case, Andy gambled and won. No major surprise, I don't think, to any of us who watch Andy Reid coach, though.
No, definitely not. One quick thought. Tom Brady is going to his 14th consecutive championship game. Charles, you've been around this game a long, long time. Just how unreal is that number?
This is beyond unreal, Jim, because we're in an era of that Pete Rozelle set in the motion of parity. everyone being 8-8, and he's somewhere celebrating that. And Tom Brady has said, I see you're 8-8, and you can stick it in your ear. It's not happening. That's why it's so different. It's not like the old days with the dynasties where the rosters were the same, and you and I could count that we could give each team the roster every year for 8 to 10 years. It's not like that anymore. 14 times, and he went to a new team and took them there again. Give him whatever kudos he wants. He deserves them.
And I'm asking you, Buffalo, how you living right now? Mafia, how you living right now? What was it like to get up this morning knowing that you're now one day closer to the Bills, being one game closer to the Super Bowl? How you living? It's got to feel good. That has to feel damn good. Because I know I could hear you on Saturday night, or at least some of you. The state of New York did allow 6,700 Bills fans into the stadium against the Ravens, but you can't tell me that was only 6,700. You can't tell me 6,700 people made that much noise. That sounded more like 67,000. That crew was feeling it. 6,700. Yep, maybe. If there were 6,700 Rick in Buffaloes, maybe. The only thing more Bills Mafia than the Bills and their fans, or I should say, sounding 10 times as loud as they should have sounded was the fact that after their team knocked Lamar Jackson out of the game and ended his season, the Bills fans were donating to his favorite charity. That's one of my favorite things about the Mafia. This is not the first time they've done that. It is such an awesome thing. It's so amazing, but at the same time, it is so on brand for the Mafia. Nothing but respect for that crew. Mad respect for that crew. And then nothing but respect for how they showed up on Saturday night, especially on this play, because as loud as they were throughout the game, there was not a better moment to lose your bleep than right here.
Takes the snap, drops back to pass, steps up in the pocket, throws to the end zone. It's intercepted! Intercepted by Johnson, who's going to come back on the near side to the 30, 35, 40. Inside Ravens territory. He's got Jackson to beat to the 20, 10, near side 5. Touchdown, Bills! A pick 6 of 100 yards! And this place is going crazy.
Westwood 1. That place was going crazy with 6,700 people. Taron Johnson, if you need him. That interception was so great. And if that's all that happened on that play, that would have been tremendous because it would have meant that the Bills defense came up with another stop to prevent the Ravens from tying that game. But you want to know what made that play so amazing? That was the first red zone turnover of Lamar Jackson's career. Since he's arrived in the NFL, he had never turned the ball over once in the red zone. And then Johnson picks him off in the red zone in the playoffs. Now, if Johnson had made that play and then taken a knee, that still would have been the play of the game. And he admits he was thinking about doing just that. He was thinking about intercepting the pass, taking a knee, turning the ball over to the offense. But instead, he made the play of the season, and maybe even bigger than that.
I caught the ball and I kind of looked down, but then I looked up. And I just seen a whole bunch of green grass to the right side of me. So I figured if I could race over there, I ain't see nobody else side me. If I got leading blockers, you know, I know Lamar's fast, but if I got leading blockers, I feel like I could take it.
Couple of thoughts there. Number one, I thought that he might take a knee. Number two, when he did bring it out, he stumbled. And if you watch that replay, it's even more impressive now than watching it live. It's incredible, actually. So I love the decision. I love the play. And most of all, I love the swagger. I love the swagger. Him saying like, yeah, I know Lamar is like the fastest quarterback ever. But if I have lead blockers, I feel like I could take it. It's pretty much how you'd sum up that entire Bills team. You'd sum up the entire Bills team because they've got that belief that I know insert player or insert team is good, but I feel like I could take it. And then they just go out and they take it. Whatever the hell it is, they take it. They rip it. Now, when I said that may have been the play of the season, even then, that might not have been going far enough. This is what Josh Allen had to say about that play.
A play that people are going to remember for a long time here in Buffalo. One of those potentially franchise-altering plays.
I don't think that's that far-fetched either. A potentially franchise-altering play. I mean, that was just one play in a masterclass from the Bills defense. Remember when everybody was questioning their ability to stop the run? Remember when people were talking about how the Ravens were going to come in and run all over the Bills? Remember when folks were picking against the Bills at home in the playoffs? Do you remember that? Maybe you don't, but Jerry Hughes does. He remembers all of it and admits he took it all personally.
Yeah, you know, we took it as a challenge. You know, a lot of us, just because we had that this late night game, we sat around, we watched TV, we enjoy football. It's our job, it's our passion. So, you know, when we see the guys on TV talking about how they don't play defense in Buffalo, or, you know, we're going to give up 30 points. Yeah, that's a challenge that we all see. We take it as a challenge and we accept it. So I think we went out there and we played like we had something to prove. And that's how you're supposed to play football at your house, especially in the playoffs.
Right. Our house. Our house. Of course they took it personally. They should take it personally. You know when people say, you shouldn't take it personally. You should. You should. Most things. Especially things like that. All the all-time greats take it personally. What do you think makes them so great? They take it personally. So that defense that was supposedly going to allow 30 points and a ton of yards gave up just 3 points, had 4 sacks, and 6 tackles for loss. Sean McDermott is amazing. Sean McDermott is incredible. I've said it before, and I'll say it again right here. Whatever the Bills are paying this guy, it's not nearly enough. Give him a blank check and let him do what he wants. He talks about vision, which is another word for culture. They have built an amazing culture. And it starts with that guy. And as long as we're doling out some love, it should not just be for McDermott. You better give some to Leslie Frazier as well. Because that defense that McDermott and Frazier put on the field, put on an absolute clinic. That was against Lamar Jackson, who had come in playing at an elite level. He was starting to look like the MVP version again. Came into the game playing at a really high level, and he had some freaky moments early on. But the plan from McDermott and Frazier was to get the Ravens into third and long consistently and then force Lamar into tough spots, and it worked. And you know there's no way that I'm going to do a take on the Bills without checking in with my main Bills correspondent, the Snowman. Because Deion Dawkins sums up this team and its mood and its mindset every single week, and this time he dropped this gem. Quote, there are so many guys on this team that are due for greatness. End quote. That is the truth. There are so many guys on that team that are due for greatness, which makes that a team that is due for greatness. And it's a city that is due for greatness. And it's a fan base that is due for greatness. Bills Mafia, you are now one day closer to greatness. What a weekend. Listen, you can rain out baseball. You can rain out tennis. You can rain out golf, but you cannot rain out life. Sometimes, no matter how hard it's coming down out there, you've just got to get in your car, brave the elements, and get to the people who need you most. That's why you need windshield wipers that you can trust. You need wipers from Bosch. Rated by Fortune as 2020's number one auto parts supplier, Bosch makes high-performance windshield wipers that handle the harshest weather conditions so you can reach life's important moments. See what matters most with Bosch. Chris Holtman is my guest. Chris, good to have you back. How are you?
Great to be with you, Jim. Hope you're doing well here in you're in L.A. I'm in snowy Columbus, Ohio here.
Yeah, my man, it's got to be cold there. Has to be cold there. So, yeah, we're doing great here, and it's good to have you back. So let me first start right here. Chris, you beat number 14 Illinois in their place on Saturday. It's a game where you outscored them 43-28 in the first half. How pleased were you then with the way your guys went on the road and set the tone at both ends of the floor from the very outset?
You know, really pleased, Jim. I tell you, this league, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, it's an incredible gauntlet. Illinois is a really good team. I think they've got legit Final Four national championship ability, and they've had some obviously really good wins. So to get there, get a start, you know, it's unique. These noon tips come at you fast. It was a noon tip. We've had that the last couple Saturdays. You got to start fast, especially when you're playing such a good team on the road. We were able to start fast, and honestly, we kind of hung on there at the end.
Chris Holtmann joining us. See, the thing about that is, especially when you deal with that team in their place, it's not just that you got out to that lead. You know, Illinois has made that habit this season of coming back on folks, not just coming back, but coming back in big ways. You know they can overwhelm an opponent. So what did you make of the way your guys did hold on in the second half and finish it off?
You know, it's a great point, Jim, because I thought that's what I was most pleased with, is the fact that we were able to kind of keep swinging there in the second half. And you said it, you know, they've had some incredible comebacks and swings. You know, their game at Northwestern, they were down 15 at the half and ended up winning by, I think, 20. I mean, it's an unbelievable swing in college basketball in a 20-minute stretch. So, you know, they've done that in a number of games. They do have the ability to overwhelm you. They've got, obviously, a tremendous guard in Ayo Dosunmu and a really good collection of talent, a big and Kofi. So we expected that. I think the deal was to stay aggressive, and we were able to attack their pressure and get some open looks and keep it really between 8 to 10 for most of the game, and then they cut it. They cut it to a possession there late. Give them credit, but we were able to hang on.
We're talking to Ohio State head basketball coach Chris Holtmann. Then back to your original point, Chris, about the conference itself and that it's a gauntlet. There are no easy nights. What's it take then to thrive and to succeed in that conference right now?
Short-term memory loss as much as possible. You really got to have the ability to forget about what happened, at least – take what just happened, good or bad, learn from that game, from that experience, because there will be weeks where you'll play, you know, in a 2-week stretch, 4 ranked teams. And you'll most of the, you know, nearly every team in our league is top 40 or top 50 in most analytics in college basketball. And you know, you're going to have 9 or 10 teams in the top 25 in this league of all 14 teams. So, it requires short-term memory loss. You got to have some perspective in this league. It can beat you up. We've already seen that from really quality teams and quality coaches, and you got to be able to forget about it and then move on and get better in the next game.
We're talking to Chris Holtmann. I would imagine also that in terms of having a short memory, that's so critical, but also you want to make sure that you've got that kind of poise, that kind of resolve where you're at your best in the toughest moments. Is it something that you can, in fact, coach and teach players, or can they only get it from going through it?
You know, I think that's a question I think coaches have asked themselves for ages, is how do you simulate those really, really important moments in the guts of a game when it's a 2-possession game or a 1-possession game in any sport? How do you best simulate that pressurized situation in practice? And how do you do it early enough, and how do you present those situations enough to where you can grow in practice before you get in those moments? I think you can get better in practice. We certainly try to do that. We certainly try to simulate those situations. But as we know, the best experience is when you have a chance to go through that together as a group in a live game experience.
Chris Holtmann is joining us. Chris, let me ask you about E.J. Liddell. He had 26-7 in that win over Illinois. Coming into the season, one of the questions seemed to be was, how is the team going to go about replacing Caleb Wesson? Outside the program, there have been comparisons made between the two of them. How do you see it? Like, is it a matter of Liddell doing what Wesson did, or does he bring something different to it altogether?
You know, it's really interesting because that was very much the question about our group. We play in a league, Jim, as you know, that has a lot of big guys. You know, in college basketball now and in the NBA, it's positionless. There aren't the traditional fives that you see that we used to see in the NBA and in college. You see really positionless basketball across the board. But in our league, it's a little bit old school in that you see some really big five men. You see big physical bodies. And obviously you got like a guy like Garza, who while he may be a five man, is also shooting nearly 50% from three. But you have a lot of big bodies. So for us, I think what we needed to do is we said, okay, how do we put our best players on the floor? And if that means we're going to play a couple forwards, because E.J. Liddell is one of our best players and we're going to try to move him around and put him in different spots. That's what we have to do to be successful. And what he's done is while he's 6'6", he's got a 7-foot wingspan, but he's really versatile. You can move him around. He's got a great frame. He can really shoot it from mid-range. He stretched it to three, and he's got a powerful physical body. that's been able to make up for maybe a lack of overall size. He's not necessarily 6'10", 6'11", but he's been able to take advantage of his mobility and versatility.
Right. Ohio State head basketball coach Chris Holtmann joining me for a few more moments. You know, Chris, I'm looking at this thing from the outside, but it seems like you're working in some new faces this year. I've talked to Eric Musselman in the past about this, and I'm talking about the approach to transfers and roster management. How much has the rise of transfers and this notion of roster management changed over the past few years, and how has it impacted the way you coach?
It's the biggest challenge for us, Jim. It's the biggest challenge for college coaches, I would say. And I don't know how it is. You know, Ryan Day and I've talked a little bit about this. I'm not sure exactly if it's completely comparable with football, but certainly in college basketball, roster management is the biggest challenge. It's figuring out what your roster is going to look like from year to year. The what it used to be 10-12 years ago is you kind of knew after the season, maybe a couple weeks after the season, what your roster was going to look like next year. You could begin to make plans. Nowadays, that's not the case. And, I think what you're going to see as the transfer rules change is more transfers continue to get recruited. You're going to see a little bit more player mobility. That may not be necessarily what people want because they like to be familiar with faces in college basketball. I still think you'll be familiar with a lot of faces, but there will be more mobility, and I think it's the greatest challenge for coaches in today's game.
So, Chris, before you go, one more thought about the way the world is right now and the other challenges involved. Like, we have a son who's at the University of Wisconsin, so I know what it's like to have a college kid going through this whole thing. And then you've got your team. As an example, because of the nature of this season, you and your wife, Lori, hosted Christmas for your players because they were unable to go home. How did that idea first come to be, and then what was that experience like for everybody?
You know what, how it came about, and I appreciate it. Late in the summer, early fall, our Big Ten coaches talked about playing on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve or the 26th. And in order for that to happen, your players needed to vote whether they were going to stay and be willing to do that. Most every team said, hey, we're going to stay through Christmas, not go see our families, try to mitigate the COVID risk. Our players decided that. And yet, as you get closer to Christmas and you know what that break normally means for players, you know, I told my wife, I said, Lori, we've got to make this the most special event possible. So I give her credit. I mean, she went over the top. She had, she got contacted every mom and they sent gifts. We talked to our compliance about, could we get an extra gear gift for them? We had a Christmas tree set up in the basement with their favorite candies as ornaments. We had a collage of kid photos where they had to guess. And, it was as much of a family feel as we could potentially provide for them, because you felt for the fact that they weren't going to be able to, they didn't get to see mom, dad, brother, sister. They haven't really seen them for several months.
I mean, how challenging is that for young players, for any college student?
It's a challenge, and I think you got to be real and as a coach and recognize it, and you can't ignore the fact. Even when they come to games right now, Jim, they've been advised. Our trainer talks to them about being limited with your contact. You know, if your family's maybe had COVID, that's a different story. But if they haven't, you know, it's limited contact. And it's just such a unique world. I think what I keep coming back to is our players want to play. That's what they've said to us. They want to do this. It's been a great, in a lot of ways, it's been a great thing in the sense that it's gotten their mind off of what's kind of went on in the day-to-day world right now. And for that, I'm grateful, and I know they are too.
Today is Martin Luther King Day, and it's a time to remember and celebrate the work and life of Dr. Martin Luther King. It's also an opportunity to reflect and acknowledge where we are as a country right now. It's an incredibly powerful day every single year, but today, after what we've seen and experienced, it feels even more significant. It feels even more profound. The moment calls for an even greater accounting and acknowledgement of how much further we really do have to go. As Dr. King famously said, and I quote, "In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check, when the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men, as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. End of quote. One half a century later, those words ring as true as ever. Dr. King set out a vision of civil rights and social justice. It was a challenge for this country to live up to its ideals. And there is still plenty of work to be done. As he said, quote, "But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation." End of quote. So if we are to be the people that we say we are, the country we believe we are, we have to cash that check. He's a good friend of the program. He is Howard Beck. What's going on, Howard? Good to have you back. How are you?
Doing well, Romy. How are you? It's the UC Davis part that is always the most important part of the intro. I appreciate that.
I love that. No, I appreciate you saying that, too. Much respect coming from a UC Santa Barbara Gaucho grad. All right, so we're almost a month in, Howard, to the season. The biggest storyline of the year has been James Harden trying to force his way out of Houston and COVID. So let me start there. If you're Adam Silver, how are you feeling about that and about the start of the season? How concerned is the commissioner right about now?
You got to think that he's fairly concerned. This has been, this last week in particular, the wave of games that they have had to postpone, the number of teams that have had their rosters just devastated, not so much by COVID cases, but by contact tracing. It's tough. You know, they rolled out the schedule one half at a time, right? When they planned out the season, they said, we're doing the first 36 games. We will tell you when the second 36 will be afterward, because they wanted to make sure that they were flexible, that whatever happened in these first 36 games, they could adjust as necessary, and that proved to be the wise approach. And I got to say, to some extent, Jim, it's important to note that, you know, while there have been COVID cases, there have been players getting sick, Karl-Anthony Towns, the latest, and that one's heartbreaking for all kinds of other reasons, but I don't think they've had necessarily as much of a COVID problem as they've had a contact tracing problem. And to their credit, they're going very strictly by their protocols to keep the league from having a bigger outbreak. But by erring on the side of caution, by being as careful as possible, they're having to postpone games. And I don't think it's gotten to a tipping point where you now have to say, well, we got to, you know, stop, pause the season and reevaluate everything. They're, you know, they've changed some rules. They're trying to tighten it up a little bit and see if they can weather the storm. But, you know, look, you and I both know this. This is not an NBA problem. This is a U.S. problem. It's a global problem, but, you know, particularly here, we are, you know, in the midst of the worst part of this pandemic in terms of infection rate, and the NBA, like any other sector, is not immune from it. So I think they're doing their best, but I got to think Adam Silver's been a bit nervous as well, given the way the last week or so has gone.
Agreed. Howard Beck is joining us. He's a senior NBA writer for Sports Illustrated. All right, Howard, what about James Harden? Now, you've had a few days to think about this. What are your thoughts on the way things ended for him in Houston, and how should he be remembered there?
Look, I think, and we saw this with Vince Carter, right? Go back, like, people have forgotten, especially the younger fans. Vince Carter's exit from Toronto once upon a time was really ugly. And everybody who remembers watching at the time, it looked like Vince Carter had basically just stopped playing, stopped caring entirely. And it got kind of ugly. And then he got traded to New Jersey, and suddenly he was reborn and you know, resumed being the great player that he was. And we remember him now very fondly. He became a respected veteran, a mentor, a great all-around leader and role model in this game. And we don't think too much. Raptor fans probably remember very vividly, but most people just kind of look at Vince Carter for what he accomplished and what he meant to the various franchises he played for. James Harden, it's ugly right now. And if you're a Rockets fan, it had to be frustrating, heartbreaking, infuriating, all of it. But he gave them 8 pretty great seasons, a couple of conference finals, a lot of great moments. And, yeah, couldn't deliver the championship, or maybe, you know, you want to argue that it was fate, injuries, not enough talent around him, the roster build, whatever. That was a pretty great era for Rockets basketball. And so I think over time, when the hard feelings subside, I think, you know, his Rockets tenure will be remembered even in Houston for the high highs and not the messy exit. But it was messy, and I don't think it was altogether necessary. I think there's, you know, everybody comes to that point in their careers, superstars in particular in the last 10 years, where you say, you know what, it's just not working out here. And if you're a pending free agent, you leave in free agency. And if you're, you know, a year short of that, maybe you tell the team, look, trade me before you lose me for nothing. In Harden's case, he really started that ball rolling way ahead of when he could have been a free agent, and that part of it made it a little bit, I think, tougher. And I think the way he applied pressure and the way he handled himself was not great. None of these cases are analogous to each other. They all kind of stand on their own. I think Harden's is at the unfortunate end of the spectrum.
Right, and for those who missed it, Howard, he shows up with the Nets, and then he goes off immediately, a triple-double, 32, 12, 14, and four steals, and in fact became the first player in NBA history with a 30-point triple-double in his debut with that team. So that was a little more salt in that wound for the Rockets and their fans. What about Kyrie Irving, Howard? He's reportedly going to miss tonight's game against Milwaukee. How do you see Harden, Irving, and Kevin Durant all working together in the event that they all work together?
Yeah, I mean, I've been saying for some time and before this trade even happened that I didn't think of all the places that Harden could land, this was not the ideal scenario to me. I thought his best fit was Philly. I thought Harden and Embiid together would be seamless. And yeah, that's two stars instead of three, so maybe it's not as high of a ceiling in terms of the talent that you can roll out on a given day. But I'm not convinced, Jim, that three high-usage, primary ball handler, primary scorer types of players can fit that seamlessly. This is not Pearson, Garnett, and Ray Allen in 2007, where they had, you know, maybe a little overlap, but very, a really complementary set of skills, the three of them. And not, you know, they took steps back. They all had to sacrifice. But they weren't all three primary ball handlers. And this is different. Durant and Kyrie Irving and James Harden are used to operating a certain way. And it was really nice the other night. Durant and Harden together were seamless. And I think those two plus a great set of role players around them could actually be a championship caliber team on its own. How Kyrie Irving fits whenever he gets back is, I think, a really big question. Because Durant's already shown, you know, he could play with Russ and Russ's high usage, you know, tendencies in Oklahoma. He could go to the Warriors and fit in. So I don't think Durant is a question. I'm not sure about Harden, and I'm not sure about Kyrie. They're both used to playing a certain way. And you assume that because Harden did force his way to Brooklyn, that was the top of his list. You assume that intrinsic to that is, if I get there, I'm going to be willing to play a little differently. And I assume that those are conversations he's had, not just with the organization, but with Durant and Kyrie Irving. So we'll see. We'll see. They have other issues too, Jim. I mean, I don't know if they've got enough defense. They traded Jared Allen. So, you know, there goes their best big man defender. And, you know, the roster, which was one of the deepest in the league to start the season, is now looking a little thin after the big three.
We are talking to Howard Beck. All right, Howard, what about out here? The thinking coming into this season was that the Lakers would be most impacted by the short offseason, and they probably have to limit minutes early on, yet they're 11-3 right now, Howard. They're number one in defensive efficiency. They're number five in offensive efficiency. What do you make of their start?
A couple of things. One is that when you're a great team, the talent still rules. Like, you know, this is just further proof that, oh, hey, the Lakers are really, really good. You know, and besides that, we spent, you know, a couple of weeks in the offseason saying, wow, look, they won the championship, and then they got better by bringing in Dennis Schroeder and Montrezl Harrell and the rest of these guys. So no surprise. I think, you know, to your point, the quick turnaround, the short turnaround, and the fact that everybody still looks fresh and sharp, part of it's probably the fact that, you know, they didn't lose any momentum. You know, if a shorter offseason means it maybe doesn't take as long to get back in a rhythm with each other, even with the new pieces being incorporated. But if there's going to be a price to pay because of the short turnaround and the lack of time to recover and this season being a little compressed, we won't know that impact until later. right? It's going to be, if there's some week that comes up where all of a sudden guys are looking like they're dragging, or, you know, guys start getting hurt, that's when you're going to say, you know what, this is where it's catching up to them. But to start the season, it's like you pick up where you left off, and everybody's in sync. So they look great. They're the favorites to repeat for a reason. But as I say, if there's a price to pay for the quick turnaround, we probably won't see it until a little bit further into the season.
Howard Beck joining us. Howard, before I let you go, I want to ask you about one more thing. I want to talk to you about Steph Curry. You and Chris Mannix were talking about him and his contract situation on a recent episode of The Crossover. How do you see Golden State handling his future?
Yeah, it's fascinating. And our colleague at SI, Michael Pena, wrote a piece about, should the Warriors, and, you know, it's like heresy to even throw this out there, should the Warriors think about what they could get for Steph because of where they were standing, you know, a few weeks ago, and it looked a little bit better of late. But they're in a tough spot. And, you know, waiting another year for Klay Thompson to come back, not knowing exactly what kind of condition he'll be in when he returns, can you make another run? And I don't think, you know, it's more of a thought exercise. I don't think Steph Curry is seriously a candidate to be traded. But it's an interesting thing to think about as he, you know, nears, you know, the whatever the tail end of his prime might be, and he still looks like he's firmly in his prime. But, you know, what are your obligations as a franchise to your superstar player? You're obligated to, I think, get the most out of them every year, to put the best talent around them that you possibly can, to make sure that every year that they are an elite MVP-type player, that you are contending, that you're doing right by them. And the Warriors absolutely have done that. And circumstances have gone against them, right? Durant's injury, Klay's injury, Klay's other injury. And the good news for them is Wiseman's looked really good so far. They've got Minnesota's pick in this draft. They'll have their own pick. If they fall in the lottery, that could be two really high picks again. They should be able to reload pretty quickly. And if Klay Thompson recovers well, then Steph Curry is going to be able to contend again while still in the Golden State Warriors uniform. And the thought exercise of, gee, should they consider trading him and what could they get and how would that work? Maybe that never has to really come to pass in a real way.
I mean, as a quick follow, I wonder, are there certain guys, Howard, and would Steph be one of them where you just essentially get a contract for life because of what you've meant to the franchise?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. And yet that was part of the story that Michael Pena did as well was, yeah, are you going to give him a max extension at some point here that's going to take him into his mid to late 30s? I think you do it. I do think that when a guy has meant as much to a franchise as Steph Curry has to the Warriors, you don't think about, gee, on the back end, it's going to be a tough contract and it's going to weigh us down or whatever. You just do whatever you need to honor what that player has meant to your franchise, to your city, or to the entire Bay Area in that case. So I have no doubt that as long as everybody feels good about, listen, this is where he's going to finish his career, and if Steph doesn't have any thoughts ever about wanting to go finish like in his hometown of Charlotte or somewhere else or chase a ring somewhere else, then I don't think they'll have any problems settling on a number or maxing him out again, whatever it may be, because that's how the best franchises, the classy franchises, operate, and the Warriors have always been that.
They always have been that. He's a senior NBA writer at Sports Illustrated, SiriusXM NBA analyst, co-host of the Crossover NBA Show with Chris Mannix and Howard Beck, and as we mentioned, the pride of UC Davis. Howard, thanks so much. Always good to have you on. I appreciate your time, as always.
Appreciate you, Romy. Thank you.
He is Rick in Buffalo. What's going on, brother?
I was there when the goalpost came down in 88. I was there when we destroyed the Raiders to clinch our first trip to the Super Bowl. And I was there when Frank Reich led the greatest comeback in league history. But the most electric I've ever seen Rich Stadium, Jim, was this past Saturday night. And when Taron Johnson made his 101-yard house call on that pick six, I damn near went into cardiac arrest. And forgive me for going Raider Mike on meth for a minute, but I got to give Leslie Frazier lots of love for the game plan he devised and a ton of credit to the defense for executing it to perfection. And while I'd hate to see Frazier leave Buffalo, the Texans would be absolute morons if they don't make him their next head coach. He's the perfect guy to steady that sinking ship and make things right with Watson. And how about my guy, Jerry Hughes? He dominated that game the way Caleb in Green Bay dominates the drive-thru at Arby's. And just like Fatboy Leb, Hughes ain't even close to being full. And I wish Patrick Mahomes a speedy recovery, because I want the entire football world to see that Josh Allen is the best young quarterback in this league. Bills 30, Chiefs 20. Go ahead and mark that son of a bitch down. War of the Bills Mafia being one big crazy family. War of the only funny part of Jeff and SoCal's claws is that idiot actually thinks they're good. War, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Thanks for the vine, Jim. Talk to you guys next week. I'm out.
My man, Rick in Buffalo. Rack him. He is still so good. Fat Leb. Fat Caleb in the drive-thru at Arby's.
Good night now.